My festival fire is right here. I think coming for you. Not yet. They're bringing. Hold on. Don't pick up. I gotta get even with you somehow.
Yeah.
Is it Joe? You better call me.
Was my test fire?
I took it off.
No, I know that. I know that. All right. Where's the?
Is this today's agenda?
Here we go.
No, I have not.
Remind me tomorrow.
Okay.
I got to figure it out. Okay.
You didn't think we would.
No, I think I owe you one.
This is a story of purpose. I get a call.
Hey, who are you? Quick question for you about a bill that's up on the agenda tomorrow. Actually, there's two, and I don't know if you know about one of them, but the one that I'm mostly concerned about is the...
Is there anybody that's been excused? Yes.
Public safety. And it's the bill that has to do with the to bring back the non-violent drug offender program. And what's the program? We have the program in
2009. It's too grand. Oh,
That makes them have to do a little bit more work,
not too bad.
It's a great idea, but it's not. 15, 15, 57.
Hey!
And our report shows that. So, thanks.
We'll send some. Great. Yeah, I'm a co-author on that bill, right? If I am, do you want, no, what did you say? Do you want me to present? Okay, perfect. Okay. Perfect. Are you even on here?
I'm not on here.
Yeah, yes. I'm not yet.
Actually, we have to take these. Richard Stanek has to leave first because he has to leave. So if you want to tell us where you are,
here?
We will.
That's yes. What I was just saying.
Things change.
By 4.
Okay. Stay the same.
Okay. Go to New Dallas. Okay, great. Great. You know, I could have you take your seats. We're going to get started. We don't yet have a quorum. We just need one more member before we have a quorum, but we're going to call to order the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. Today is Tuesday, March 19th. Members, we just got a quorum. And so we're going to take House File 1556 and 1557 out of order because Sheriff Stanek is here and needs to testify on those, and then he's going to be leaving. So, can you chair?
Representative Hilstrom moves House File 1556 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Members, this bill was brought to me by the sheriff. And so this deals with civil commitments and folks who are in custody of the jail. And I would like to turn it over to Sheriff Stanek.
And I'm sorry, Representative Hilstrom, did you have a DE 1 amendment too?
I do.
Representative Hilstrom moves the DE 1 amendment. All those in favor of getting the bill into the order that the author would like, signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to turn it over to Sheriff Stanek to talk about the issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Good afternoon. My name is Rich Stanek, Sheriff in Hennepin County. I'm going to keep my comments brief because I know that you've got many bills in front of you this afternoon. You probably don't want to go into the evening hours, right?
Right.
You got other things to do.
Speak for yourself.
I'm here in support of House File 1556 and House File 1557. Representative Hilstrom is correct. We had come to her from the sheriff's office and the sheriffs across Minnesota and asked her to consider this legislation, and we are very thankful that she has done so and brought it before your committee this afternoon. In the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, we've been focusing much time over the last year or so reviewing some of the issues of mental illness in our criminal justice system. Not an easy issue to walk a fine line on. I authored two different commentary pieces in the Star Tribune about these issues over the last several months. And in January of this year, the Minnesota Sheriff's Association adopted the principles to address issues of mental illness in the criminal justice system. And Madam Chair, members, one of the bullet points on the Sheriff's Association reform agenda is making sure that people who need mental health treatment are getting it and not languishing for long periods of time in our county jails. As the sheriff of Hennepin County, I'm responsible for the operation of our largest jail in Minnesota, the Hennepin County Public Safety Facility. Every year we book somewhere between 35 and 40,000 folks through the front doors. I estimate about 25 to 30% of them suffer from mental illness, If you talk from other sheriffs across the country, they may say it's upwards of 55 to 60%. Now, often our jail staff must operate as frontline mental health workers as it's challenges for them. People who suffer from mental illness, members, require far more resources than the average inmate in our jails. For instance, the risk of suicide amongst mentally ill jail inmates is far higher than among the average populace in our jails. The Sheriff's Office has won a national award for our mental illness training program for our detention staff. Yet even with these best practices in place, we know that a jail is not the best place for someone with a mental illness. Instead, they should be receiving psychiatric treatment in a more appropriate setting, such as a state psychiatric facility. Madam Chair, members, it's been taking much too long for them to get there. Those with mental illness are spending too much time in our local jails. In 2012, the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office had about 30 inmates committed to the custody of the Department of Human Services. They were determined to be mentally ill and a danger to themselves and or others through the courts. On average, these 30 individuals spent over 10 days in our jail after the issuance of a commitment and transfer order, and that's important. That was after the issuance of a commitment and transfer order signed by a judge in Hennepin County. This delay is not acceptable, and this is just the delay after the commitment order is given. Now, we can't forget about the delays before this ever takes place. In one case from Hennepin County, it took 15 months from the date of arrest to the date the inmate was transferred to St. Peter for inpatient treatment. Now, let's just say this guy's name is John Doe. He was arrested. It's one of my favorite names, John Doe. He was arrested and booked in the Hennepin County Jail on April 8th of 2010 and was charged with six different felonies, including attempted murder in the first degree. Almost a year later, on March 17th of 2011, he was determined to be incompetent to stand trial due to mental illness by the courts. He then waited in jail for three more months for further psychological evaluations and hearings until June 21st of 2011. He was committed to the custody of the Department of Human Services as mentally ill and dangerous and transferred to St. Peter for inpatient treatment. The court's medical expert concluded that his behavior is dangerous when his condition is not treated. Again, Madam Chair and members, behavior is dangerous when his condition is not treated. Yet he sat in the jail, which is not a mental health treatment facility. I run an adjudication facility for 15 months for the whole process to work before he was placed in appropriate treatment. And because of the jail environment, many of these inmates find their mental health conditions get worse. Again, Madam Chair members, we do not treat those who are mentally ill in a pre-trial, pre-adjudication facility such as our jail in Hennepin County. Those with mental illness should not languish in our jails for weeks and even months waiting for the proper care they need and deserve. Now, we need to find a way to make this a quicker process, and both the House Files 1556 and 1557 seek to do just that by combining the incompetency and civil commitment evaluations, by having firm deadlines by which inmates are moved out of the jail to a treatment facility after being civilly committed by court. We believe this will have a positive impact on public safety. And when I talk about we, I'm talking about the 87 sheriffs elected to represent the citizens of Minnesota. Now, this will ensure people who need mental health treatment are getting mental health treatment and not languishing in jail for long periods of time. And Madam Chair, members, I do appreciate your consideration of these important issues and for Representative Hillstrom and others for bringing these bills forward. Thank you.
Is there anyone else to testify for or against the bill? Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Anna McLafferty. I'm the Criminal Justice Director at NAMI Minnesota, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Minnesota, and NAMI strongly supports these bills. Our criminal justice project focuses on keeping people living with mental illnesses out of the criminal justice system as much as possible, and when they do get in, we seek to ensure that people don't get more deeply into the criminal justice system simply because they live with a mental illness. And NAMI has been working since early last year, partly with the Sheriff's Office and lots of other stakeholders, specifically in Hennepin County, to develop recommendations to reduce the length of time that people with serious mental illnesses do spend in jail. If an attorney requests an evaluation for a defendant's mental competency to stand trial, so often this happens when someone does have a serious mental illness, and especially if the person is found not competent to stand trial and then goes through a civil commitment process, which is automatically triggered if someone is found incompetent, that can add weeks oftentimes months, to the person's time in jail simply because they live with a mental illness. So we looked at data from intake all the way through to release, and we were hoping that there was kind of an easy answer, that there was one part of the system that was really causing things to back up. But we found that at every turn, there was something that was kind of delaying the process and adding to the amount of time that people stayed in jail just because they had a mental illness. And so we really worked with stakeholders in Hennepin County to develop ideas for shortening that time at every turn. And these two bills fit into that work. For people in jail who have been civilly committed, NAMI here is not just from Hennepin County, but across the state. This is really a statewide issue, that people stay in jail for months after a commitment order and a transport order until a treatment program has an availability, whether it's a treatment program in a hospital setting or in the community. And for people whose attorneys order a competency evaluation, the psychological examiner often knows when they first meet with that person whether they also meet the standards for civil commitment. They're really looking at the same things, even though the standards for incompetency and the standards for civil commitment are different. They're looking at the same underlying issues, and they often know when they do that first evaluation whether the person actually meets standards for civil commitment. And they are very much in a good position to make a recommendation about combining the two evaluations when it's appropriate. And yet, they aren't able to do that at this point. They have to wait often weeks, sometimes over a month, for that second evaluation to come up, even though the examiner could have told you right off the bat that the two could be combined. So NAMI strongly supports these bills. We think they're a great step in the right direction, and we thank Representative Hillstrom for authoring them. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my guess is that if they're not being held in jail and they're being held, you know, in a facility such as St. Peter, what would the cost to the Department of Health and Human Services be, and are they here to say yay or nay on this bill?
Representative Hillstrom, do you want to take that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Scott, I have heard from them. They sent me a packet, but I would assume if there's a fiscal note, that would be taken care of in health. And it's not really the judiciary's, but I would assume that if there's a fiscal note, they'll let me know.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sheriff Stanek, you talked about support from 87 sheriffs. Is there an official position from the association?
Sheriff Stanek.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members. I get a thumbs up. So Mr. Franklin's in the back of the room. I'm just confirming. He's the executive director of the Minnesota Sheriffs Association, and the Sheriffs Association does support Representative Hillstrom's legislation today.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, maybe this is for the bill author, and I assume we're on House File 1556, right, not 57 at all, but line 1.6, and then also again on 1.18 of the bill, the term an appropriate level of security is used. I'm wondering what this means and what it would mean practically, whether it creates ambiguity to use that that term, or if there's a definition that would be readily understandable.
Ms. McLafferty.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, it does create ambiguity, and that's intentional. The decision about where the person should be treated is something that should be up to a mental health professional, and that's one of the things that's recommended in a psychological examination in these cases. And so some people may be determined to be appropriately placed at St. Peter, while others perhaps at Anoka, and still others at other hospital settings, and still others in the community. So it kind of depends on the situation, and they look at things like risk and what's going on psychologically with the person to make that decision.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the law enforcement folks and the DHS staff are normally would have this normal discussion. This is something that would happen seamlessly. Are there any? Is it going to create hiccups?
Ms. McLafferty.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski. The system already works in this way. They are already making this determination, and that's already part of the process, and it seems to be working very well.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One last question. It appears that we are creating a mandate then, or maybe systemically decreasing the flexibility by doing this, because we're saying, well, you can no longer be held in a jail past 2 days, which the jail would seem to give you the ability to flex in terms of time, but we are making that we're making it very rigid right now and creating some rigid boundaries, which would appear to push a mandate upstream or downstream or wherever the stream goes to DHS and create some additional requirements for them, additional budget requirements, and require them to accept that flexibility or assume that flexibility that is now being housed within the jails. So you get what I'm saying? The ability to flex in and out. What does that mean?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, I'll take that question if that's okay.
Sheriff Stanek.
This would be my answer. The way it sits now is when that determination is made, we contact Human Services that there's a transfer order. We think that they should get to it in a reasonable amount of time. 48 hours seems to be reasonable. We're a 24/7, 365 a day operation, as they are. They wait until a bed is available. Sometimes it takes several days, sometimes it's a week, sometimes a lot longer. The bottom line here is we're putting timelines into the legislation because the jail is not a place for someone who needs that mental health treatment to get it. They simply do not get that at any of the jails operated in the state of Minnesota. We are a adjudication facility, a detention facility, not a treatment facility. Human Services already has the ability to be able to do this. We're pushing them a little bit, true, in terms of some timelines. But as we've seen over the last several months, when we've pushed, the timelines have fallen dramatically compared to what they were. As I mentioned, back in 2012, in my county alone, we had 30 individuals who, after that transfer order was given signed by a judge, they remained in custody in the Hennepin County Jail for 10 or more days. After having some conversations with the judge in Human Services, that timeline started to fall. It started to be up to 6 days or 5 days or 7 days. Better, but not quite good enough yet. The people who are in custody and are unable to stand trial because of their mental capacity should be treated at a facility that is appropriate for them, not held and languished in a jail or a detention setting. That's what we're trying to get at.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Ms. McMarney, is it? Hope I didn't butcher that too bad.
McLafferty.
You had mentioned some of the facilities as St. Peter or county facilities or some of the community facilities. What happens if they have pending criminal charges, if they're going to the community facilities? And I've had the experience myself after 27 years in law enforcement. Due to HIPAA, they do not notify us when these people are released. They're pending charges. They're not out on bail. They've gone to this for their treatment, and then they release them back to the public. Now we have an issue with the endangerment to the public because they're releasing these people into the public.
Ms. McLafferty.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think it sort of depends on the situation, how that tends to play out, but I know that is it's a frustration of law enforcement, whether they're bringing the person to a hospital directly or whether they're seeing the person be brought to a hospital setting or a community-based setting through this process, and then they're not notified when the person is released. In this particular process, the person would, assuming that they've been, they're facing a certain charge, and they go to, let's say it's a hospital, let's say they go to St. Peter. If they end up basically confined in St. Peter for a certain amount of time, that would be basically equivalent to if they had been found guilty of the charges that they were facing, they would probably be released at that point. If that was not the case, they would have to go back into criminal court and continue to face their charges once they were treated back to competency. Most people are treated back to competency within a shorter amount of time and are able to be brought back for their criminal charges.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I want to thank Executive Smith. That still doesn't resolve the issue. I've actually have personal experience from this. I had a relative that was picked up, sent to a facility, was released before, and law enforcement was not notified. Because he was released, he had no conditions on his release. He was able to continue the activities he was doing. So to me, that's a serious problem, because just because it is a problem. Then another issue that we have, you have 48 hours. There's times that literally our jail has been calling every place in the state for a bed. There's times that we've waited 3 weeks for one bed to be open. Now there's going to be a lot more requirements and a lot more people trying to get these beds. I think this 48-hour rule is just going to be too strict, and talking with my county attorney, he said basically impossible to implement with the implementation date that you have listed on this bill.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Johnson, these folks have already been committed by a judge, and we're just trying to get them to the proper place in a timely fashion. Olmstead is here, and they can talk about their shortage of beds if we need to go there. But the fact is, we're not changing what happens once someone is committed. We're just saying that once the judge has signed the commitment, that they need to be moved to the proper place in a timely fashion.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Sheriff Stanek. I'm wondering if you could share with us the approximate cost to Hennepin County taxpayers for a night at your jail.
Sheriff Stanek.
Well, we're a little cheaper than the Hilton, a little more expensive than the Red Roof Inn. We run about $125 per night to spend a day with us at the Hennepin County Jail. I venture to say that the Department of Human Services will tell you that there is a substantially more. But the bottom line here, again, members and Madam Chair, is that the jail does not provide treatment to those who are mentally ill and in need of that treatment. Instead, they wait and wait and wait in jail. They become more disenfranchised, if that would be the right word. They become more vulnerable to the other inmates, the folks they're housed with, sometimes violent towards the staff. And so what we're asking for, and I think this goes to Representative Johnson's question earlier as well, is that, look, once they are, judge signs the order to transfer to the Department of Human Services, let's move them to Human Services, where Human Services then can get them the proper treatment, medical treatment that they need to deal with the mental illness. That's really the bottom line.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Sheriff Stanek, and perhaps to the other testifier too, you stated that there's 35 to 40,000 people that you arrest and house in the jails annually. And then you alluded to the fact that you had about 30 people that you knew of in your county that were mentally ill, and the court saw it and they handled it. I'm just wondering, with this new legislation, do you see, I'm sure that number is going to pick up considerably if they're diagnosed right away. And so what I'm just worried, I guess, along with Representative Johnson, that there's going to be the capacity within the Health and Human Services Department to take care of these folks.
Representative Hillstrom?
We could have another testifier.
If you could state your name and then answer the question. Thanks.
My name is Roberta Opheim. I'm the State of Minnesota Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and I've been in that capacity for 20 years. When you talk about capacity, that you really hit the nail on the head. We're in support of this bill because we believe that timelines need to be placed there for both the civil and human rights of the individuals with mental illness. The worst thing we can do is put them in a situation that will make their illness worse. A jail is that setting because they're not equipped to deal with it. Part of the problem exists, and the reason that we have these waits, and while Sheriff Stanek referred to, you know, 12 days a week, 2 weeks, there were some cases that went into the months that people were there. We have a flow problem in this state. Some people call it a bed problem, some people call it a flow problem, but for those on the committee who may not be aware, under the Americans with Disabilities Act, there was a decision made called the Olmstead decision. And that said you may not keep someone in an institution simply because you do not have the resources available. Now, the individuals that are in the jail and have subsequently been civilly committed or committed to for treat to competency and return to the courts, those individuals need to be in the beds that are in St. Peter and Anoka. For lesser crimes, there are people that could be treated in community facilities and return to their normal lives more quickly. But we haven't had the ability to get people out of St. Peter and out of Anoka. There are about 130, 145 people between those two institutions that have met all of the criteria to be ready to be transitioned into another facility, a less restrictive facility, which is what the Olmstead decision requires. And we can't move them out because the state of Minnesota doesn't have enough of those resources. That was recognized, and the state of Minnesota was sued in a federal lawsuit, the outcome of which is requiring that an Olmstead plan be written for the state. Because if we can't get people out, then we can't get the people in who need to get in there. And the system definitely is moving in the direction of expanding the types of homes and living conditions that those with lower levels might be able to move out on their own. Those with some level of need could move to the less intensive resources, freeing up the most intensive beds for the individuals there. And this has been a problem for the last 10 years or more. And anyone who stays in, even in a hospital longer than they medically need to be there, deteriorate. So we have to get the flow moving, and I think this bill does a lot. It's the right thing to do from a human and civil rights perspective, but it's also the right thing to do to get them to the right level of treatment that they need in the most timely manner. And so I think there's capacity there. We are not using our capacity, and we haven't developed the adequate capacity, and I think that has to happen. And timelines are a wonderful way to make things happen.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for members? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, this bill, Madam Chair, is going to public safety. Is it also going to HHS?
Representative Hillstrom.
At this moment, they haven't requested it, but I assume that when the fiscal note comes in, it's going to show that it has to go there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Seeing no further questions, Representative Hillstrom renews the motion that House File 1556 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion prevails. One bill down, seven to go. Representative Hillstrom moves House File 1557 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Hillstrom, do you have an amendment?
I think I do. Do you have it in the packet? Or is it oral?
It's an oral amendment, I believe.
Right. So on line 1.14, at the end of the sentence, we'd like to add the words, and the examiner recommends combining the examinations.
Are there any questions on the oral amendment? All those in favor of adopting the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, amendment is adopted. Representative Hillstrom, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And the same folks are here about this bill as well.
This basically says that when the court is doing a competency, mental illness, or deficiency evaluation and civil commitment examination, that for the purposes that the court rule that is in place of criminal procedure is Rule 20, and that when they do that assessment, they can make it joint, and that it then does satisfy Minnesota Statute 253B.08. It's just allowing it all to be combined when the examiner recommends that that happens. And we're here for questions.
And are there questions from members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I remember right, I think this is the bill where the, yeah, it says when the prosecutor defense counsel doubts the defendant's competency, are the prosecutor and defense counsel, are they equipped to diagnose or determine if a person needs this competency examination?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, that happens as a matter of course. Anytime either the prosecutor or the court or the defense attorney has a question about whether or not the person understands what's happening, any one of those can raise and request a competency evaluation.
Representative Scott.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And so do the defense attorney and the prosecutor have to agree on that, or just one of them?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Scott. If anyone thinks that it should happen, they then ask the court to approve a Rule 20, and then the court approves it.
Are there any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, shouldn't, I mean, if you don't have the requirement built in the bill that the two would need to agree, wouldn't this be an opportunity for the defense counsel to move their client somewhere else or to stretch this out?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Drazkowski, no, that's under current court rules that any party can do it, and so we're not changing the court rule process. We're just saying that if you do that one examination, it should satisfy the statute as well. There's no reason to do more than one examination.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 1557 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Bill passes. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If someone would move House File 975, and I also have an A2 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Benson. I would move that House File 975 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Government Operations. And I will move the A2 amendment. Representative Benson, do you want to describe
yes,
the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment was recommended by this Senate Counsel for House File 975's companion in order to make clarify technical changes in the Cultural Ethnic Leadership Advisory Council that was created in Article 2. It does not substantially change the bill, and the bill continues to have no fiscal implications, Madam Chair.
All those in favor of adopting the author's A2 amendment to get the bill in the form that he would like, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Benson, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will turn this over to Judge Rubenstein, who will go through the bill for you. And then Mr. Patrick Carter is here from the department, too, if there are other questions.
Welcome. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes. Chairman Hillstrom, members of the committee, my name is Joseph Rubenstein, and I'm a human services judge with the Minnesota Department of Human Service. I'd like to briefly go through Article 1 of the bill. It's, for the most part, a series of conforming amendments to technical changes. So lines 1.26 to 2.4 conform the statute on who can be a human services judge to the department's longstanding practice of hiring only licensed attorneys to be human services judges. I checked this morning, and I'm told that at least that the last non-attorney that the department hired was in roughly 1998. Lines 3.9 to 3.14 are intended to address an ambiguity that was enacted into law in an earlier session. The language that you see lined through was placed in its present position in the statute, giving rise to an interpretation of the law that said that the 30 and 90-day hearing periods only apply to maltreatment hearings, when in fact those 30 and 90-day periods have always applied to all classes of fair hearings. So this amendment strikes that language from its present place in the statute. And if you will look at lines 4.18 through 4.29, it moves the language to a separate clause H, which we believe makes it clearer that those time frames apply to all classes of fair hearings.
Judge, I'm going to interrupt you for just a moment because we have a really long agenda, and so we're really only going to talk about the parts that are within the jurisdiction of this committee.
And I apologize, Madam Chair, could I get some guidance on what you want to talk about?
Absolutely. And so actually the reason why I brought this bill here is because, one, this was the first time I learned that there was a group of judges that were not within the judiciary. So that was news for me. And so my question then becomes, once the judges make a decision, is that decision then appealable to the judiciary?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, quite simply, what we do is the same thing that ALJs do. We make a recommendation to the commissioner or the commissioner's delegate. Once the delegate or the commissioner signs off on it, then the decision becomes the commissioner's action, and it may be reviewed either by a request to reconsider to the department or direct appeal to the district court, which sits as a court of appeals with some exceptions, or a person can ask the decision be reconsidered, and if they don't like the department's response, then it's appealable to the district court.
So, Judge, are you creating any new right to appeal to a district court, or are these all just current rights that already exist?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, all of these rights already exist in statute. There are no changes to the rights that already exist in statute.
Members, that is the reason the bill needed to be here, so we could confirm that. If we could just take some questions, Representative Benson.
Madam Chair, also, Mr. Carter just gave me a note. He indicates that this bill does not have to go to government ops. They saw the same language in House File 310.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, members, I know it's a narrow scope that we're looking at here, but you described it as just a bill with technical changes, but Article 2 creates a huge council.
Did
any of that finance come from us, or am I misreading it here? And in the summary, it says creates a council or something, and there's like 25 members on this thing, or 15 to 25 members. Am I in the right bill?
Representative Cornish, I couldn't hear your question. You got to talk into the microphone. I'm sorry.
On this bill, in Article 2.
Yeah, it's Article 2.
Yeah, you had said something about it being a technical changes, this whole bill, but it looks like you're creating a council of 15 to 25 people. I was just wondering where the funding for that's coming from. Anything to do with our?
That would not be within our jurisdiction, Representative Cornish.
It just looks like a major bill. But okay, thank you.
And Madam Chair and Representative Cornish, I do apologize if I misled you. I had intended to say I was here only to address the language in Article 1, and I apologize if I misled the Chair or you.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Rubenstein, on the bottom of page 3 on line 3.33, it says the amended language would say, if the district court proceedings are completed, dismissed, or overturned, the matter may be considered in an administrative hearing. What does that mean?
Judge,
go ahead. What lines are you referring to, Representative Drazkowski?
Madam Chair, 3.33 through 3.35, Judge.
Go ahead, Judd.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Gostkowski, these refer to in appeals involving claims that a person maltreated a minor or a vulnerable adult. Right now, the statute expressly provides that if the events giving rise to a treatment of maltreatment of a minor or a claim of maltreatment to a minor also result in proceedings in district court, we are required to suspend our proceedings until the proceedings in the district court are completed. We have, as a matter of practice, also suspended proceedings involving an appeal of a maltreatment of a vulnerable adult while the circumstances involved there also give rise to district court proceedings because for a couple of reasons. People are very often reluctant to testify on their own behalf when the testimony they give before us is under oath, is not privileged, and may or may not be used against them in the district court proceedings. And we've always believed that, to require them to appear while those proceedings are pending forces an appellant to choose between exercising their right to a hearing and exercising their Fifth Amendment right. So the language here simply conforms the statute to the current practice that we have regarding cases involving allegations of maltreatment of a vulnerable adult, also that result in proceedings in district court.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Judge.
Representative Cornish, to answer your question, I've just learned that there is no fiscal note and that on page 11, line 11.8, it says that the members of the council receive no compensation for their services.
Thank you.
Other questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 975 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 Oppose?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Benson. Okay. Representative Allen. Representative Allen, are we doing 252 first, or are we doing the other one first, 829?
Madam Chair, 252.
Okay. Representative Allen, welcome to the committee. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. In 2007, the state of Minnesota and the tribes executed an agreement providing for the transfer of pre-adoptive placement cases in tribal court. In 2011, the state Supreme Court overruled the District Court of Appeals decision. The Supreme Court's decision was based on the state's understanding that the state did not have the statutory authority to transfer pre-adoptive placements to tribal court. This bill returns the proceedings to where the state and tribe agreed these matters would be best addressed while providing protection for litigants. This bill would not alter the court system. Simply, it would return the system in place that operated in place until the October 2011 decision. This bill is necessary to address the court's finding that tribes have no inherent jurisdiction over such proceedings. What this bill is asking the legislature to do is nothing new. The legislature expanded the protections afforded Indian children under the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act. Previously, the legislature expanded the definition of Indian child. Madam Chair, I have Judge Andrew Small here, and if you don't mind, we could go to questions at this point. So,
okay. Are there questions from members? All right, Representative Allen.
And if there's no questions, I'd then have Judge Small make a statement. And he's a tribal court judge and serves in children's court.
Okay. Before we do that, it's my understanding that Representative Scott wants to move the bill. Representative Scott?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know why I'm getting stumbled up on that. I'd like to move House File 252 for passage and then be to refer to the General Register.
All right, Representative Scott moves the bill. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Andrew Small. I'm a tribal court judge and for the Lower Sioux Indian community. And I'm a children's court judge there. I've been a children's court judge for 17 of the last 19 years and have worked almost exclusively on child welfare issues and specifically Indian child welfare issues. We have worked with the state judiciary to improve communication among the courts. We've worked on putting together rules that help the implementation of the act. We've gotten the tribal state agreement signed by the commissioner. We've done a judge's bench book so that state judges have a much clearer understanding of how an ICWA case in their court would work. And so I just give you that as background because I'm quite familiar with the interplay between tribal courts and state courts. But what I wanted to emphasize was that when a case gets transferred to tribal court, I'm the one that receives it. And I'm the one that determines, ultimately, based on expert recommendations and the rest of that, where a child would be placed if it comes at a pre-adoptive or adoptive state. And I have a practice. I've established a practice like a lot of other tribal judges have done. I know that there have been complaints about late intervention by tribes. And that it takes too long and affects the child if you transfer to tribal court. But I established a rule a long, long time ago that when the tribe is notified by county that they're looking at a motion to transfer jurisdiction, I have a standing general rule in my court that I need to be notified of that within 1 week and with an assessment of whether or not we can provide adequate services to the child in order to justify accepting jurisdiction. So we do this quickly and we do it efficiently, and I have a report that comes to me with that in a week's time. Now, as I said, we have communication, we've established communication through something we started called the Tribal Court State Court Forum, which is acknowledged, confirmed by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and we do trainings at conferences that are put together by the Chief Justice for judges on civil jurisdiction and ICWA issues. We do a lot of communication. We do a lot of work with each other. So I'm really aware of how difficult it is when these things come up and a motion to transfer from a tribe comes up and the state judge has to figure out, is this a good case to transfer? Is there good cause not to do this? And what we try to do is discuss these things informally between ourselves to see if we have the resources, you know, what the status is, who the players are, that kind of thing. So I'm the one that these cases come to when a motion to transfer is accepted by the tribal court. The federal law and the state law allow for a tribal court to decline to accept jurisdiction. So if I have to decline it because we don't have the ability to service someone properly and provide everything that they need, then I'll decline. But when these things come in, I'm the one that it comes to, and I'm the one that makes these difficult determinations about where a child should be placed. The other thing that that I can offer you is that much of, in the smaller tribes, much of the caseload involves non-Indian people, as well as Indian people. There's clearly jurisdiction over a tribal member child, but a lot of times there are grandparents, there are caregivers that become part of the case. There are pre-adoptive parents that become part of the case. They all come before my court, and everyone is treated exactly the same way. When the ICWA was passed, it tried to emphasize that the tribe's relation to the child was on parity with the child's relationship with his parents. That tribal relationship is the most paramount issue relative to the ICWA and the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. But at the same time, I can make a decision under my law that says, I believe you've been with your non-Indian grandparents and there's good connection with the tribe and there's no reason to disrupt this. I could make that determination. So that's how these things function at least in Minnesota in most cases. And I just thought it would be helpful to you to know how that works when we do get a case.
All right. Questions from members? All right, seeing none, anything else, Representative Allen?
No, Madam Chair, thank you.
All right, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Representatives, my name is Janine LePage. I'm an assistant county attorney in Crow Wing County. That's Brainerd for anyone who's not familiar. I have worked in that capacity for almost 17 years, and while working there, I have worked almost exclusively in child protection. I typically handle between 100 and 150 cases at any given time. I would say every year I handle 3 to 5 cases that fall under the ICWA. I have worked with multiple tribes through the state of Minnesota, Wisconsin, Oklahoma, Alaska Native, South Dakota. I think that's probably about it. During that 17 years, I can recall 5 cases where children were adopted by a non-Indian family. One of those cases involved paternal grandparents who were not Indian. So really 4 cases that there were non-Indian adoptive parents outside of the preference. 2 of those cases took over 4 years from the time the children went into care to the time that there was an adoption petition filed. And then generally when we file that adoption petition, it's about 3 weeks until we finalize. So when we talk about these late stage issues, we really mean late stage. I mean, a lot of these kids are old enough to know what's happening. They know they're being adopted. They know what's going to transpire. So my comments here today are really based on my experience. I am a part of the ICWA subcommittee with the County Attorneys Association and the Juvenile Law Committee. I know that other attorneys throughout the state have experiences similar to some of mine, different than some of mine. I think over 17 years, we have probably contested an issue with a tribe half a dozen times. This isn't something that's always happening. Generally speaking, we are working in conjunction with the tribe, trying to serve a child's best interest and a family's best interest. I was reading through the fact sheet presented to you all from Jacobson Buffalo, and I don't disagree with a lot of it. When the RS case came out, I was actually really disturbed by it because we want the opportunity to transfer to tribal court at, you know, the point of adoption. When RS came out, I actually thought about the fact that we had transferred a case to White Earth for a customary adoption after parental rights had been terminated in district court because everyone agreed. And I think that's probably what happened in Fillmore County is everyone agreed. This isn't an issue about whether we want to have this available to us. I met with Judge Small last week trying to come up with a compromise. And as I did more research, I realized we don't have the ability to reach a compromise. This is jurisdiction that's been granted to tribes through Congress. This isn't something that the state can come in and expand upon and undo. Under the Indian Child Welfare Act, Congress said in cases where a child lives on the reservation, they call it child custody proceedings. And child custody proceedings is defined as adoptive placements, pre-adoptive placements, CHIPS cases, and termination of parental rights. So it says that in cases where children live on the reservation, the tribe has exclusive jurisdiction, and they specifically use the word child custody because they mean all four situations. The very next section talks about concurrent jurisdiction between states and tribes, and it says that the tribes have the ability to assume jurisdiction on a transfer in CHIPS proceedings and terminations. If they had meant to confer upon the tribes jurisdiction in adoption cases, they would have said child custody proceedings, just like they did in the other section. They didn't. Not only did they not do it, this has been challenged at the congressional level on at least two occasions. It appears that there was an attempt to change the language in the concurrent jurisdiction section to say child custody, referring to all four areas, in 1988 and in 2003, and it wasn't adopted. It wasn't passed. We have a situation where Congress has made its decision. We don't get to come in and undo that. I mean, that to me would be like there's a state child support proceeding, and one of the participants in that child support proceeding is a member of one of the Indian tribes. And the tribe says, well, we want to bring it over to tribal court. We can do child support in tribal court. We have an inherent authority. We have it in our code. We want to bring it over to tribal court. There isn't jurisdiction to do it. Just like we can't just send a case to Iowa because everyone wants to send it to Iowa. There needs to be a vehicle to get it there. So as much as I wouldn't mind having the discretion to transfer to tribal court to do a customary adoption. I haven't been to one. I've heard their beautiful ceremonies. I've heard adoptive families say that they would, you know, that they would always recommend that over state court. Our adoption proceedings aren't this wonderful festival. We don't have the ability. I mean, that's what this issue is we can't do it. Not that we don't want to do it. The remedy is when we get to a point where we're looking at permanency for a child, that's the point where the tribe should be saying, okay, well, I guess, you know, we might as well bring it over to tribal court at this point, and we'll address permanency. And then if they do a suspension of parental rights, they can go on and do a customary adoption. But once that termination is done, the Congress has said there's no longer a way to transfer this to tribal court. Jurisdiction does not exist. And the concern, if this is passed, number one, it's probably going to be litigated, and some family is going to be caught in the middle of this litigation. It also allows for the tribes to essentially nullify any state court order. They could nullify a termination of parental rights and return children to a parent whose rights have been terminated. They could nullify a case that has gone up on appeal and been upheld on appeal. The tribal codes that I have reviewed do not give full faith and credit to state court orders until they have reviewed them and ensured that they meet a number of areas. And one of them is that they don't violate tribal custom. I hear on every single ICWA case that I have, the tribe will not support termination of parental rights. It's inherent in the tribal culture that they will not support termination of parental rights, ever. They will support suspension of parental rights, which always allows a parent, at some point under certain circumstances, to be reunified with their child, but they won't support termination. I understand that. I don't have a problem with that. But the transfer then needs to happen before there's a termination proceeding, before that issue is adjudicated by the court. It's not supposed to happen afterwards. There isn't a remedy for it. There's a lot of discussion about the tribal-state agreement conferring jurisdiction. In 1979, I think, when the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, came out with guidelines to help state courts understand the ICWA and interpret it, in the commentary they said, we also know we need to expand upon and give you some guideline on what tribal state agreements are supposed to look like, what they're supposed to do. And they said they were going to have something out the next year. To my knowledge, nothing ever came out from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It appears, however, from references to tribal state agreements, that the purpose of a tribal state agreement was really to implement procedures and processes for making sure that when the transfer happens, it happens timely. You know, what is the process for a transfer when it's when there's a petition for a transfer of jurisdiction to tribal court? What's the turnaround time? What's the response supposed to be? What kind of paperwork should be filed? How to implement services? What kinds of services should be available? That was really my understanding of what a tribal state agreement is. Tribal state agreements, argument, they are not law, and they cannot expand upon jurisdiction that's created by Congress. So.
Thank you. Questions from members? All right, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I would agree with the county attorney that the tribal state agreement can't confer jurisdiction because, and we argue that the Supreme Court just simply got it wrong. I mean, tribes have inherent jurisdiction over these types of cases, so that is just, that's a fundamental difference in how we interpret the case, federal law, and this case. And regarding the opponents also argued that this change would somehow mean that Minnesota's Indian children would suffer due to the late transfer of cases to tribal court after terminations have already been ordered in state court. And this is a red herring. First of all, it is absurd to imply that state courts would make transfers even when there is good cause not to do so. The ICWA itself talks about how to decide whether there is good cause not to transfer a case, and there are other cases in Minnesota that already deal with this issue. It is simply not relevant here. The issue of timing of transfers is separate from the question of whether a whole class of child welfare cases, pre-adoptive proceedings, can be transferred at all.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Allen or Mr. Small, this bill is a result of the court decision that we've been talking about that happened in 2010. And do you recall what the county attorney's group was, what their position was at that time?
Yes. The county attorney actually filed all the way through to the Supreme Court, filed a brief in support of the transfer.
Okay. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Allen, last year we worked on this bill, and the county attorneys expressed some concerns with the bill. And do you recall what those were and what was done as a result of those discussions?
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott. They came last year we first introduced this bill and talking about the late transfer, and we had discussed that, and also about who could petition. And at that time, it was that the parents determined there were other parties that could object. I'm sorry, not petition, but object to. And so we removed, and after those discussions, we removed that language. And I'm not sure now, but maybe Judge Small can answer that about how that's fundamentally different than what they're doing right now, but answer that.
Judge Small, and if I could get you to talk into that microphone, actually, so it gets on the record. Thank you. Judge Small.
Madam Chair, I wasn't exactly sure your question was, has their position fundamentally changed?
Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Mr. Small, Representative Allen and I worked on this bill some last year, and the county attorneys had some concerns, and we met, and Representative Allen actually met with them, and I was just wondering if those issues had been resolved, if they'd been settled, and I know they were discussed.
Madam Chair.
Judge Small.
Representative, the issues that had arisen last year, in fact, were resolved. There are a lot of issues that have come up this year that are new issues.
Thank you.
Representative Scott.
I think that's my only question.
Further questions from members?
I would just encourage support of this bill. It's a bipartisan bill. We've worked on it for over time, and sometimes Congress gets it wrong, sometimes courts get it wrong, too. So this had been working for years beforehand, and all the tribes are in agreement, so I would just encourage support.
All right. With seeing no further questions and no one else in the Judge Small.
May I interrupt you?
Judge Small.
I usually don't have to ask that, Madam Chair, but in my court. I just wanted to note for the committee that there's a misreading, and it's very important, and I do this with all due respect, but there's a misreading about whether or not the authority exists for this kind of transfer. The only case that the United States Supreme Court has ever heard on ICWA was decided in 1989, and in that case, it was after the adoption that the tribe went in to try to invalidate the adoption because they said that the state court hadn't followed the ICWA. And the Supreme Court finally found in favor of the tribe, the United States Supreme Court. But the interesting thing that they said, it was an identical situation, kind of status. We were in pre-adoptive state here in Minnesota. They were already into a completed adoption. But the Supreme Court left the decision as to whether or not there was authority to hear this in the tribal court to the tribal law. And I brought that for you just so you can hear the Supreme Court's language. They said, we were assured at oral argument that the Choctaw Court has the authority under the tribal code to permit adoption by the present adoptive family should it see fit to do so. And that was a non-Indian family off the reservation. So what the Supreme Court was emphasizing here is they could have said, well, there's no tribal law. In federal law, this is prohibited. It's prohibited under the ICWA. They didn't do that. They left the question as to whether or not the tribe had the law or was exercising inherent law to do that, and they cited the tribal code for its authority. So to say that there is no jurisdiction to do this is simply wrong, and this is the language from the Supreme Court to support that.
All right. Representative Scott renews her motion that House File 252 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Representative Allen, you have House File 829. The chair moves that House File 829 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Allen, please keep in mind, members, that we have 20 minutes left of committee and 1, 2, 3, 4 bills left to hear, so we'll probably be coming back. Representative Allen.
Madam Chair.
Y'all set, Representative?
Yes.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill deals with, it does four things, and Mr. Alwood can provide more detail and sort of walk you through some of the details. But basically, it provides remedies for failure to inform prospective tenants that the property is in foreclosure, and then it protects tenants in foreclosed properties. It extends the time to appeal a housing court decision, and it clarifies tenant requirements to file a tenant remedies action. And then I'll have Mr. Elwood walk you through the bill, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Elwood. If you could please limit your discussion to the sections within the jurisdiction of this committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood, Legal Aid, if you could refresh my memory as to which sections that would be, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, all right. So we have Section 4. You're dealing with the time for appeal. Okay. You're dealing with the notice for the hearing, right? This is for the court hearing. Is that correct?
The tenant remedies action.
Yep. And then I think that's it. So tell us a little bit about the bill, but basically talk about the provisions. Please talk about the provisions in our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. This just to point out that we work very closely with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. I want to thank Todd Liljenquist and the association for working so closely with us. This is the product of an agreement between the two of us. And so the two issues that are before your committee is one extends the time of appeal of a housing court decision from 10 to 15 days. The reason that's necessary is because when a housing court decision is issued, oftentimes it gets through the mail and it frankly doesn't get to the either the attorneys for the landlord or the tenant for several days, and then that 10 days that is currently in law all of a sudden shrinks. And so we're actually just trying to kind of keep enough time for either side to evaluate whether to appeal. Frankly, there aren't that many appeals, but when they are taken, they're important. The other section is a very technical section that currently under law, if there is a tenant remedies action taken, the tenant is required to pay the outstanding rent into court. However, there's just an anomaly. What if the rent isn't outstanding? Does that mean the tenant can't file the action? And this simply clarifies that even if the rent isn't due, the action can be filed, and that is it.
Questions from members? All right, seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 829 be recommended to pass and be sent to the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Allen. Representative Morgan, are you next? Welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill here. Where does it go next?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Government operations, unfortunately, but you got to do what you got to do.
All right. The chair will move that House File 767 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Morgan, this is a big bill, and we really only care about the areas within our jurisdiction.
Section 17, Madam Chair. Section 17 is what I'm told.
So please briefly tell us what your bill's about, but focus on the areas that are within the jurisdiction of this committee.
It's a Department of Human Services bill on continuing care, but Section 17 is about county adult protection units, and Rachel Shands will talk about what Section 17 actually does.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rachel Shands. I'm with the Department of Human Services, Aging and Adult Services Division. Section 17 of this bill requires all county adult protection units to use a validated structured decision-making tool in order to carry out work that is currently mandated by state law. When the county receives a report about potential maltreatment of a vulnerable adult who lives in the community, county adult protection units are responsible to investigate this report. Counties also provide necessary protective services to vulnerable adults who've been subject to maltreatment. And a vulnerable adult is a person over the age of 18 who, because of a physical or mental disability or due to dependency on services, is vulnerable to maltreatment. In 2009, six Minnesota counties collaborated on the development of a structured decision-making tool for use by adult protection staff. And the counties involved in this effort were Dakota, Hennepin, Olmsted, Ramsey, Steele, and Washington counties. Research supports the conclusion that for our complex decisions, structured frameworks result in more reliable and accurate decisions than clinical judgment alone, even for highly skilled professionals. And the structured decision-making tool is designed to reinforce the clinical judgment of adult protection workers along critical decision points of the assessment and investigative process. The counties support the use of this tool. The tool won the 2012 County Achievement Award from the Association of Minnesota Counties. This proposal does nothing to change the statute or rule regarding the function of the common entry point or the lead investigative agency regarding reports of maltreatment of a vulnerable adult. Rather, this is a new tool that is available to counties to support their work. Use of the tool reduces the potential for bias and promotes equity. It provides evidence that can be used by law enforcement. It also promotes the rights of vulnerable adults through the use of a process that respects privacy and self-determination while promoting safety and protection. And again, this proposal would make the use of this tool mandatory by all county adult protection units. And with that, I will stand for questions.
Questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. Representative
Draskowski. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, is there a fiscal note for the bill?
Anybody know? No, not that we know.
Oh. I'm wondering too, Madam Chair, local impact of this, a local impact note, is there going to be additional costs to counties because of this?
But Representative Drazkowski, we haven't requested a local fiscal impact note. But if you know if there's an impact, go ahead. Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, this is a web-based tool. The counties access it through a secure portal at no cost to them. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, further questions from members? With that, I renew my motion that House File 767 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
All right. Is Representative Liebling here? Representative Liebling. Where is it going?
Madam Chair, we have a DE1 amendment, and I would also like to incorporate a change into the DE1.
Okay. Members, Representative Liebling has the DE1 amendment. So first, I will move that House File 946 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Register. And the chair would move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify.
Madam Chair?
Yep.
I do need to incorporate a change into that if we could before we move the amendment.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On line 1.7, after that, I would like to insert the words the person or, and then delete the other place on the line where it says person. So it should read, if the person contacts a 911 operator to report that the person or another person is in need of medical assistance. And if staff could just make sure that makes sense, it would be great.
Staff? Ms. Perry? Can you repeat the amendment, Ms. Perry?
Mr. Chair, members on line, this is an amendment to the H0946DE1 on line 1.7. After that, insert the person or.
And then you want to delete, then it says the person or another. Yes, that's correct. Thank you.
So you're leaving the second person in the line?
Yes, Representative. Sorry, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair. Who's Madam Chair. Sorry, we don't have a copy of this bill in our packet.
Does it look like this on the front?
Oh, I do. All right, let me look again.
Okay.
Thanks.
Otherwise, we'll get you another copy.
No, I do not have it.
Does everyone else have it? All right. So, all right, Representative Liebling incorporates that oral amendment into the DE1 amendment, the chair incorporates that, and then the chair moves the DE1 to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, the purpose of the DE1 was to incorporate changes that came from some discussion with the County Sheriff's Association. Mr. Franklin had worked with us to clean the bill up a little bit. Members, this is a really important little bill, and what it does is it tells our young people in the state of Minnesota that if they are consuming alcohol illegally, which is something we all agree we don't want them to do, but if they're doing that and they should have a medical emergency, or someone whom they're with has a medical emergency, that we, the state of Minnesota, would rather that they get help for that person or themselves rather and not be concerned about getting a ticket for underage drinking. So what this does is it's basically immunity from prosecution for just an underage drinking ticket. That's all, not DUI, not anything else, just underage drinking or possession of alcohol by an underage person. And we want them to know that if they have an emergency, we want them to report that emergency. So what we've done here to tighten up the bill is it used to have a provision that would allow them to walk into a health facility or a detox program or something. We've narrowed the bill, so now they have to call 911. If they call 911 and they report
that a person is in need of medical assistance for an immediate health or safety concern, and they provide their contact information, and they stay on the scene and cooperate with authorities, that they will then have immunity against getting a ticket for underage drinking or possession of alcohol. So it's a pretty simple bill, but an important bill, because we really need to let young people know that we care more about their lives and their health than we do about giving them a ticket at a very difficult moment. And we've got in the, I just want to point out in the audience, we have a group of students here who are here to support the bill. This has actually been brought forward by students, and these two young men next to me, I don't know if the chair has time, I know you're in a big hurry here, but this is really their bill. They brought it forward, and I think that this is a bill that, in fact, will save lives.
Thank you. So if you could just state your name for the record and give very brief testimony, that would be helpful.
Sure. I'll shorten up what I had to say. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matt Forsty. I'm a student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and I serve as the chair of the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition, which represents students from across the University of Minnesota system. Of course, I'm here today in support of House File 946. I really see the need for this change in the law, because when medical emergencies arise in these underage drinking settings, young people are currently hesitate or fail to call 911 because of the fear of the prosecution for underage drinking. And I'll just highlight one brief study that suggests that that's the case. In a 2011 survey of over 12,000 Minnesota college students conducted by the University of Minnesota's Boynton Health Service, 14% of students that were surveyed indicated that they would be unlikely to call 911 if they were unable to wake someone that had passed out. And I think that's something that indicates that there are tragic outcomes that are possible, and we certainly want to avoid those outcomes. So I'll skip the rest of my testimony unless there are questions, and just say please support this bill, and thank you.
All right. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Taylor Williams. I'm the student body president at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. Whether it is a student who's attending a party and drinking for the first time that becomes ill and needs medical attention, or a young woman who is sexually assaulted and needs to seek help, current state law discourages that individual from seeking assistance. So I ask the committee to please put our safety and dignity first. Thank you.
Questions from members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that this is a good bill. My concern is there's no limit to the amount of times that they can do this for one person. And I just don't want it to, I want there to be some consequences so that this person is not becoming basically an alcoholic at school and just call 911 and there are no consequences. So do you understand what I'm saying? I can see, you know, a couple of times letting them by with this, but after a certain point, to me, the parents need to be contacted, the university officials need to be contacted, and, you know, we just don't want to enable someone to continue that behavior. So,
Representative Labeling.
Thank you. Well, Madam Chair, Representative Scott, there has to be a medical or safety emergency. So, I hear you, it just seems that it's so much more likely, it's so unlikely that this would continue to happen. And if it's continuing to happen, there is sort of a built-in, if you're drinking and getting into big health consequences, I think there's more of an impediment there than just getting an underage ticket. So I hear you, but there is something to be balanced here. And I think what wins out is that we want students to report the emergency.
Madam Chair, members, if I may answer a part of the question there, status quo remains for universities and high schools that currently contact students or parents after an incident like this happens. So, for instance, at the University of Minnesota, every time a student goes to the hospital because of an incident like this, they're contacted by administrators and have to go through psychoeducational training, which is essentially a short course explaining, you know, what happened and how can you prevent this from happening again.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Representative Leaving, you said that there has to be a medical reason. So what's the standard for, what's the threshold for a medical reason?
Representative.
Does there have to be, Madam Chair, does it have to be documented? Does a physician have to say, yeah, this is legitimate? Or can I just say that I've got a medical condition and then boom, I'm off the hook?
Representative Leibling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesh, we've tightened up the bill, so you have to be calling 911. If you're calling 911 and saying, I've got a health or safety concern, and you don't, I think there are consequences already for making a false report. So I think right there, I'm not too concerned that people are going to be, if somebody thinks there might be a medical emergency, I'd rather have them call and be wrong. I think that's what we want them to do.
Well,
Representative Wash.
Madam Chair, I've been a prosecutor in St. Paul for 12 years, and trust me, there are no consequences for making a false report. It happens all the time. My question is, what is the medical standard for the medical standard threshold for this bill? Does anyone have to check it out and find out if it was a legitimate medical reason, or that it's simply the statement of this individual that they had a medical problem?
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, well, we tightened up the bill so that you actually have to be making a call to 911. It can't be where a police officer comes and you say, oh, officer, I've got an emergency here. Therefore, you know, it might not be something serious. So you actually have to be calling. So if you didn't have a real emergency and the police weren't there, I don't know why you would call to get the police there so that you could get immunity. It seems like you would just simply go home, sleep it off or whatever.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lesch and then Representative Cornish.
Thank you. So I can tell you right now, it's parties. Someone says the cops are coming, and the cops are on their way, and I say, wow, I'm in trouble. I'm not going anywhere. I whip out my phone and I call 911. Would that be a loophole in this bill, and if not, why not?
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch. Representative Lesch, there's always, in anything we do, there's going to be some loophole. I think it's a weighing of harms here. If that would ever happen, I would submit to you that would be a rare event. I think what we're talking about here is situations that are very serious where somebody's life or health is at stake. And we want students to make that report without fear of the consequences. And when people are intoxicated or when they're young and they haven't really thought things through, they might not have the best judgment. And often what these students have told us is that often they're more afraid of the ticket than they are of letting their friend sleep it off when they don't know how serious it really might be, or of not calling. They would tend to worry more when they really should worry more about the medical emergency. That's the sort of situation we're worried about. I can't tell you that will never happen, but I'm a whole lot less worried about a few people getting away without a ticket than I am about a few students getting away without needed medical care.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, I won't have another question, but just by way of comment, I get that, Representative Liebling, and if that's what happens, I think it's a good thing. I do have some concerns that I don't think it's going to go down that way in future years after if this bill gets passed. And I just wanted to state that for the record. But to the extent it can save a few students who need it, that's a good thing.
Thank you. Representative Cornish.
Well, Madam Chair, remember, just real quickly, Representative Liebling, I told you I liked your bill last time I heard it in the other committee. And I asked if you wanted to work on some things, and it's obvious you did and tightened it up quite a bit. If you have to call 911, you have to remain, you have to cooperate, and I like you, doubt if students are going to fake a 911 call and all the things that go along with it to get out of this. So I think it's a good bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. With that, the chair renews her motion. Where is it? That House File 946, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Isaacson's bill is next. Members, if we could just stay a few minutes extra. Members, this bill, House File 1206, we just needed to make sure that it didn't have a fiscal note in our area, and it came back with no fiscal note. So, Representative Isaacson, if you could be, like, so short, because we're going to pass you on to Representative Paymark's committee where you belong. Representative Isaacson, the chair moves House File 1206 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bill to regulate, in essence, the tattoo industry. And the part I think you're speaking to is that there is a gross misdemeanor if you're caught in violation, which is completely consistent when you're caught in violation of other industries representing yourself when you're unlicensed.
All right. Questions from members? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Isaacson, what are some of those examples? I guess maybe I'm not aware of what those examples are in other industries.
Representative Isaacson.
I'm going to defer to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Matthew Duff. I am with the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm the credentialing and establishment inspection specialist for the Body Art program. Specifically, this is in relation to practicing body arts, tattooing, permanent cosmetics, body piercing without a technician license or practicing in a place that is not a licensed establishment.
Yep. Further questions? Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I didn't get my question answered. So we are going to create a gross misdemeanor for somebody who doesn't become properly licensed and violates it. That's what I understand, Representative Isaacson. What are the other examples that you referred to in statute that somebody can get a gross misdemeanor for not being licensed?
Madam Chair, I misunderstood the question. I apologize. We do get it now. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Duff.
Madam Chair, Representative Druskowski. Other healthcare occupations that have the gross misdemeanor penalty include hearing aid dispensing, chiropractic practice, nursing, optometry, and psychology. Specifically, hearing aid dispensing, that's a member of the Health Occupations Program, of which the Body Art Program is in the Trader Division.
Further questions from members? All right. With that, members, this does not have a Senate file because it's in an omnibus bill, and we are only hearing this because it got sent to us. So Representative Isaacson, the chair would renew her motion that House file 1206 be recommended to pass and sent to the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you.
And with that, members, we are adjourned.
I want to go home.
So, have you been wrangled or bullied?
Are you an attorney?
I am.
You get to kick me. There's more attorneys around here than I've ever seen in my life.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
The body piercing is equivalent to
where's the guy for this?
But what about
oh, I got a good one for you.
Thanks, Paul.
Kelly.
Thank you. I have a committee at 4, so if you could help me, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I was trying to make it.
Oh, no, that's okay.
I was just trying to make sure that I had all my committee reports.
I'll pick up the folders because I keep them in order, but... Oh, and the name tags too. I pick them up in order. But just like the papers would be awesome.
Double checking before I left that I had
everything.
I had a page in the committee I was doing that took my folder and emptied out all the papers from it. All my bill, and I just about wanted to shoot him.
Oh no.
I had to retrace all the amendments, all the things.
Oh yay.
I was not happy. he didn't do it on purpose. He just thought I was not wanted the folders.
But yeah. Still, easy mistakes for me.
Do you know what Ben Eileen. Oh, you're still here? Okay. Good.
Well, I will. No. No,
I've got to run out there.
Okay. You want it for a little more second for me? It's up in the corner in the door. Oh, it's a little late, Bob.
Yeah.
Sorry. Thank you. You're my favorite representative for the day.
Uh-huh. For the day.
For the day.
Oh. For the day. You're not going to. Yeah, you must have had a clue.
Huh? Yeah.
Is he a
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.